Irina Gut, Only a Girl. The following epic performance poem, Irina Gut, Only a Girl, written and performed by Janet Rogers, is based on the autobiography of Irina Gut Opdyke, titled In My Hands. I will start at the beginning, because it started a long, long time ago. Before time, before there was a Poland, the trees wept as they fell into the Wisla River. The great river carried the trees north to the Baltic, where their tears mingled with the salt water. Centuries passed, and the fishermen on the coast hunted the shoreline for those tears that had become golden pearls of amber, washed smooth by the waves. From Byzantium, from Rome, from the steppes of Siberia, and from the Holy Land, the merchants came north in search of the amber that held the sun in its heart. Then the Teutonic knights swept like a storm into Poland and took the amber prisoner. No one could buy except from these German knights, and the Polish smugglers were put to death in the fortress of Malbork. When the Germans stormed once more into Poland in 1939, we smuggled again, but this time it was not amber. They were tears of another sort. My name is Irina Gut, and this is my true story. I was born on May 5, 1922, in the town of Kozienice, Poland. At 1 year of age, my pet dog saved me from drowning in the river that ran by our home. Blessed by both the local rabbi and the priest, who said, "God has plans for you, Irina." We must watch to see what little Irina does. My family life was a happy one. I had four sisters, my mother, Mamusia, who loved everything that lived on this earth, and my father, Tatush, who was an engineer. The Black Madonna. When I was 9 years old, we moved to the town of Chesnokova and lived close to the fortress of Jasna Gora, the home of the Black Madonna. Each year, as pilgrims approached the shrine on hands and knees, my sister, Janina, and I would offer lemonade to the pilgrims. At Christmas time, when the church filled with incense and the murmuring of the priests, it was possible to believe that the Black Madonna was indeed the protector of our land. This was in the early 1930s, when it was still possible to believe such things. Because of my father's abilities as an engineer and factory designer, he was in great demand all over Poland. As a result, my family moved often, finally to a town close to the German border. It was here in school that I learned to speak German, a skill that, along with my blonde hair and blue eyes, no doubt saved my life on more than one occasion. Hero stories. A tomboy, you'd call me, climbing trees and running free. In my notebook, I'd make up stories where the heroine would be me. Christmas time was a joyous time for my family. Laughing and singing, Mamusia, my sisters, my grandmother, and I would spend the whole day in the kitchen preparing the traditional Polish Christmas dinner. Pierogies, breads, cookies, pickled fish, potatoes, and of course the old Polish favorite, cabbage. At Christmas time, it was an old Polish custom to drop hot wax into a bowl of cold water. The wax would twist and turn into fantastical shapes, and when the wax was removed from the water, it was said that the shape of the wax could predict a person's future. Predictions. Born to righteous adventures, told the hot wax that cold wintry night, surrounded by sisters, songs, and joy. How was I to know the war to come, the bombs to fall, the lives we'd lose, my pounding heart so often trapped by barbed wire fences, yet sometimes freed by those who dared to defy those horrible menaces? As a teenager, I joined the Red Cross and I found the experience much to my liking. So, at the age of 16, I enrolled at St. Mary's School of Nursing in Radom, Poland. This was the first time in my life that I was separated from my loving family. So, trying to forget my loneliness, I threw myself into my nursing studies. When I came home for the summer holiday, I was shocked by the changes in my town. "Don't buy from Jews," spoke signs in the shopkeepers' windows. "A Poland free from Jews is a Poland that is free." How could that be? My parents said stay, but I returned to Radom to continue my nursing studies. September 1st, 1939. Watched by Germany and the Soviet Union like a bone drooled over by two hungry dogs, Poland was the first country to satiate Hitler's rabid hunger. This could not be me. The drone of airplanes reached my ears. The sky grew black. The earth turned red. Shaking with the terror of the bombs, I ran through smoke and billowing dust to reach the hospital. The air filled with screams. Sirens shrieked like lunatics. I crouched in a ditch as German planes roared overhead. My city was on fire. People running, bleeding, screaming for their children. A toddler naked where his house once stood. I could not speak, but darted forward toward the hospital. Doctors barking orders, patients moaning, the wounded everywhere. I stood in blood, ducking with the whistle of each bomb. This could not be me, I thought, caught in the middle of a war. The Polish army, retreating for the Wisla River to the east, as Hitler's troops advanced, needed nurses and doctors to accompany them. The escape. I raised my hand to volunteer. "Hurry up, we're leaving now." I climbed aboard a Red Cross truck filled with moaning men, cars burning, houses crumbling, the roads littered with household things, the sky behind us thick with smoke. We crossed the Wisła River, a headless horse floating by. Speaking of the future to come? A hospital here, a train station where we moved the wounded to the train and left, leaving summer behind in a trail of weeping steam as we headed east toward the town of Kovno. Our train finally reached Kovno, where, at a warehouse, it unloaded us, a group of exhausted doctors, nurses, and 200 injured soldiers assembled, waiting and waiting and waiting in the cold, dreary morning. Finally, a Polish general stood before us and announced, "The Polish army is through. The Germans and the Soviets have divided Poland between them. We are now standing on Soviet territory. There is no more Poland. You are now free to go, to fight in the forest, to return to your homes. Take what you need from the warehouse. Take everything. Take it all." A girl without a country. My feet were on Polish ground. How could the land not be? I could not understand. Was I now a girl without a country? We headed toward the forest. Trucks filled with blankets, guns, clothing, bottles of vodka, bags of flour, canned meats, cartons of cigarettes. And here we lived in the forest, a ragtag army without a country. Unwashed, hungry, shivering, lice-infested. Could this be me? I'm only 17. Trading goods for food, we moved through Ukraine, like shivering, sick animals, scavenging to survive. Then 9 Russian soldiers caught me, beat me, raped me, and left me for dead in the snow under the frozen stars. Discovered in the snow, I was brought to a Soviet hospital where I slowly regained my health. When a female doctor learned that I had been a nursing student, they put me to work. For 2 years, I worked as a nurse while being a prisoner of the Soviets. Here, I learned to speak Russian. One day, I learned that Polish nationals were being allowed to reunite with their families. And after a harrowing interrogation by the Germans, who were now in control of the western part of Poland where my family lived, I was finally reunited with my family in Radom, where they were now staying with my mother's sister. My father had lost his job. My family was surviving by making black market shoes out of old tires and blankets. Signs with very strict rules which all Polish people must obey appeared on every street corner. Nazi rules. If you dare to help a Jew, your punishment is death. If you sell on the black market, it will be your dying breath. If you see a German soldier, step aside and let him pass. If you disobey these rules, this breath will be your last. No questions asked. The joy of reunification with my family did not last. One Sunday morning, as I was sitting in church, the church was raided by SS officers. The Germans needed workers. All able-bodied Poles were forced to work in the German ammunition factory. One day, hungry and anemic, I fainted while working on the assembly line. And when the German manager, Major Rugemer, discovered that I could speak German, he reassigned me to work in the hotel restaurant, negotiating with Polish vendors and serving German officers. I was permitted to live at home, and fortunately, the kindly German cook, Schultz, who had daughters of his own, made sure that my family and I were well fed. Only a girl. I served dinner to German officers. I came and went. An invisible servant, I did not count. I was, after all, only a girl. But I listened as they talked of progress at the front. I listened to the secretary's gossip from Berlin. I listened to the German words cleaning up the Jews. If an officer thought I had a crush on him, so be it. So much the better. My weakness, my advantage. I was, after all, only a girl. Part of my duties was to take out the garbage. I would drop the bags each day in an alley that backed the Jewish ghetto Glinice. It was here that I witnessed the atrocities of Jewish ghetto life. A drop in the ocean. Below the ghetto fence, I dug a hole no bigger than a loaf of bread. Each day I placed a box inside filled with cheese. And dread, I might be caught and killed. By morning light each day, the box was there, emptied. One day, I brought the box to place beneath the fence. The fence was there, but nothing else. The ghetto bulldozed to oblivion. A crushed hat, a suitcase burst, a silver candlestick were all that remained of human life among the mortar and the brick. And trumpeted from speakers city-wide came Hitler's voice, all full of pride. This town is now Jew-free. As the German army pressed on toward Soviet Russia, my sister Janina and I, unpaid slaves of the Third Reich, were commanded to travel eastward and to provide meals and housekeeping for the German officers. Their destination was Ternopil in the Ukraine. Here, we met Helen Weinbaum and her mother, two Polish women, one married to a Jew who had been taken by the Germans. One Sunday in July, Helen and her mother begged my sister Janina and me to accompany them to a nearby village where a group of Jews were being rounded up by the SS to be taken somewhere. Where? We did not know. Helen hoped to find her Jewish husband Henry there. The Fat Bird. Birds flew. Camps disappeared. All dead. And then phrases reached our ears. Burn the synagogue, shot the men, orders from Berlin. Who knew what to believe? We arrived and moved in one direction toward the marketplace. Behind a barbed wire fence stood hundreds of Jews marked by yellow stars. We pressed against the wire, searching for Henry. Raus, raus, verhuckten Schwein, screamed the guard, shooting into the air, and then he aimed his gun at us. We were running, running for our lives. We slipped into an alley, found a door, and pushed it hard. It was a house, a former Jewish home, everything smashed to pieces. We ran upstairs and peeked out the window, and with horror in my heart, my breath stopped. I pressed against the glass and saw a flinging motion, something rising toward the sky like a fat bird. And with his other hand, the German aimed his gun, and the bird plummeted to the ground beside its screaming mother. But it was not a bird. It was not a bird. And then he shot the mother. It was at that moment that I knew I must do more. A new face began to appear regularly at the hotel restaurant. It was one of the most handsome men I had ever seen. Blonde and blue-eyed. Lucifer in the flesh. SS Rokita Sternbahnfuhrer. His eyes as cold as ice, and yet so blue, so handsome, so compelling. With lustful view, he gazed upon my sister, her body he desired. I knew at once his purpose on this earth was deeply mired. His mission in my country was very clear to me. The death ring on his finger spoke, "This land will be Jew-free." I learned that Helen's husband was valet to this man. He too would listen carefully to SS Rokita's plans and send word to the ghetto. Get out now while you can. 1942. The Germans were now speeding up the actions against the Jews in Poland and Ukraine with daily forays to thin out the Jews in the ghettos. It was clear to me that the workers who I were now supervising in the laundry would be next. One morning, they told me of their decision to escape to the forest. I did not ask myself, should I do this, but how will I do this? You must understand that I did not become a resistance fighter, a smuggler of Jews, a defier of the SS and the Nazis all at once. One's first steps are always small. Now, I was making plans to get a wagon from the farm where Helen lived and to transport in secret my friends 10 kilometers from Ternopil to the black-shadowed forest of Janowka. I was now 20 years old and had been in the middle of the war for almost 3 years. At this point, I had 2 goals. One, to foil the Germans as much as I could, and 2, to die in not too much pain. A wagon to the forest. Using cigarettes and vodka procured from German stores, I borrowed that wagon from a farm outside the wars. With bony horse pulling, I headed toward dark woods, hoping that my Jewish friends were waiting where they should. My heart was beating madly as they crawled beneath the hay, and then, quite nonchalantly, I continued on my way. Without a sound, I stopped by the forest deep and dark. I shook each hand to say goodbye, promising never to part. Each Sunday, whenever possible, I procured that bony horse and delivered stolen foodstuffs to my friends with no remorse. I was on my way back to Ternopil one day after delivering food to my friends in the forest when I decided to stop at a church in Yarovka. It was a little wooden church. The priest was speaking when I kneeled and took my seat in the back. At first, needing a moment to calm my beating heart, I did not pay much attention to what the priest was saying. But when I began to listen, I realized that he was encouraging his flock to resist the Nazis and to help the Jews. Father Josef. I looked up at him, this old, bald, wrinkled man, with upright carriage and voice so strong, and I knew that I must speak with him, so I waited until everyone had gone. "Good morning," he said. "I am Father Josef." I shook his outstretched hand. "My name is Irina, Father. Your church is so pretty, I had to stop."
"Perhaps God asked you to stop," he said.
With tears welling up in my eyes, I said, "Perhaps." "Is this your wagon?" asked Father Josef, stroking the horse's bony head. "Yes," I answered. "At least I borrowed him from a friend."
"Making a delivery?" he asked.
I joined him at the horse's head, rubbing its velvety nose. "I would like to tell you about something, Father, that happened to me when I was captured not long ago." I told him everything, the lies I had told, the deceits I had sworn to, but I did not tell him that I was helping Jews.
"Irina," he said, "this is war. God knows your heart, and God knows what you are doing with that wagon today."
We were both silent for a moment. "Thank you, Father Josef," I said at last.
"When you come through Yanovka next time," he said, "stop by and visit me."
"Next time?" I asked.
Father Josef made a small wave as he walked back toward the church. "Dozovichenia," he said. "See you." At that moment, I knew that I could trust Father Josef.
I never forgot about my friends in the forest. As often as I could borrow the wagon from my friend Helen, I would bring them foodstuffs. The forest and the forester. I visited my forest friends on one hot summer day. I knew how hard their lives had been, though they would never say. They spoke of summer mushrooms, fresh berries, and river trout. But Miriam was sick with a cold or something worse, no doubt. We kissed goodbye without a sound. I climbed aboard the wagon, knowing that winter would soon be here with cold breath, but like a dragon. My friends were safe for the moment, but I had never felt so alone. Many letters had I sent to my family, but received none in return. And then Helen told me of a forester some kilometers off the road, a former Polish army man and resistance fighter, I was told. I rode my bicycle to his house, met his wife and two small kids. At luncheon, we discussed the past in Polish.
We told no fibs.
"My God, I know you," he exclaimed. "I was with you the night you were captured. We never expected to see you again. Thank God you're alive and without a fracture." I put my head on the table and wept 3 years of tears. We had not recognized each other after all these difficult years. Still, I dare not tell him the secret of the Jews I had hid in the wood. I needed to know more about him before I could trust him this truth. We talked of places we had visited, Polish songs and favorite foods. I was happier that day than I had been. It was one of my rare, joyous moods. But now winter days were approaching. Cold winds were starting to blow. My friends in the forest would need protection to keep them from the frosty foe. Meanwhile, the Russians were winning, pushing back toward the west we had heard. But were they really any better? The whole idea was rather absurd. But now, with the Soviets advancing, we used tar paper to blacken at night, the leftover pieces Kind Schultz gave me for my cousin, the forester, and his wife. All over Europe, people were living like animals in the wood, hunted, frightened, exhausted. My whole world was going kaput. Massacres, executions, deportations, these words had reached my ears. Would the war soon be over? Each day played on my fears. May 1943. May 5th, I turned 21. An old woman I felt I must be, filled with outrage, hatred, rebellion, for the poison infecting my country. Assigned to the hotel laundry, 6 more Jews to supervise each day, Ida and Lazar Haller, the couple whose opinions held sway, Fanke Silberman and Moses Steiner, the latter a pessimist I knew, Clara and Thomas Bauer, lovers forever true. Major Rugemer, who, as you'll remember, was the German manager of the ammunition factory, was becoming increasingly irritated as SS Rokita kept eliminating his Jewish workers. Fed up with the noise and constant confusion at the hotel complex, Major Rugemer decided that he wanted a house in town, a villa of his own. He asked me to be his housekeeper and to supervise the painting and repairing of his new home before he moved in. What could I say? I was in fact his prisoner. One day in July, as I was serving SS Rokita and Major Rugemer in the dining room, I overheard SS Rokita speaking to the major.
Listen, I'll tell you something, since you are my friend. You must know by now that the Führer wants all Jews exterminated. Once we finish with the Jews, we'll eliminate the Poles and their tiresome Catholic Church. You will have your workers, but we must cleanse this land once and for all. We're scheduled to finish with the Jews by the 22nd of this month. Overheard conversation. My legs shook. I had heard the truth. My strength gave way. I dropped my tray. This gave me 6 days to find a way to save my friends in the laundry. My Jewish friends had built false shelves in the laundry, so if the day should come, they would be ready to hide. On July 21st, at my urging, they hid behind the shelves. When a German soldier came by to rout out any Jews who had not been brought back to the work camp for extermination, I made sure that my friends were safe by speaking with a loud voice as the German soldiers approached the laundry door. Major Rugemer's villa. Major Rugemer, old and gray, took that villa not far away. His housekeeper, he had appointed me to serve him meals and clean for free. To the Polish families that were living there, I gave bad news that even though they were not Jews, they had to leave. But now, Lady Luck joined hands with me. In the villa's basement, where no one could see, were servants' rooms, secure and dark. Space for my friends, or was this just a lark? In haughty German voice, I ordered the work to be done. From the cellar to the roof, the painting completed, and all of this done by the German Huns. My friends would live down below, where Major Rugemer, I hoped, never would go. I devised a way to move the Jewish workers from their hiding place in the laundry to an air shaft over the toilet in Major Rugemer's apartment, and finally, when the painting was completed the next day, to the servants' rooms in the basement of Major Rugimer's new villa. More Lady Luck. Once again, Lady Luck joined hands with me. A concert and a party for the Germans would be. The hotel was empty, except for a few, and the crescent moon disappeared right on cue. One by one, I smuggled my friends to the air duct in Rugimer's suite, where they stayed for the night as quiet as mice, while drunken Rugimer snored in his sleep. The following night, without a sound, down the coal chute each one was bound to live below the German. Helen's Henry, too, would join them there, escaping SS Rokita with moments to spare. And here they stayed with me above, waiting on Major Rugimer, a man I could never love. By day, my friends could come upstairs for cigarettes and news. At night, the Major would return with no hint that he was being used. That deaf, snuffling codger would often party above, sustained by his food and his Nazi friends, and my gracious, servant-like love. This villa had been built by a Jewish architect, and there were rumors that it contained a secret hiding place, which indeed it did. A tunnel ran from a space behind the furnace in the basement to a small dirt cellar beneath the gazebo in the backyard. This proved useful on more than one occasion, since there was always the threat of discovery. My Jewish friends cleverly rigged up an electrical warning system with a button installed under the rug in the front hall. When I stepped on the button, a light in the basement would flicker on and off. One flash meant stand by for more news, two flashes, be careful, and constant flashing, danger. One day, Major Rugimer arrived home early, and I had forgotten to lock the front door. He discovered six Jewish women in his kitchen. One awful day. Our secret by Major Rugimer was found that Jews were living underground. To keep this secret, Rugimer agreed, if his mistress I would be. What could I do? What could I say? It had to be no other way. I cringed inside and smiled bemused. The one power that was only mine, my pretty face I used. Winter 1943. A gallows tale. Deep cold was now pinching the city. High drifts on each side of the street. I took a route usually avoided, where gallows hung like dead meat. A crowd blocked my way homeward, SS men ordering people to stay, herding the crowd round the gallows on this frigid, cold winter day. Seven nooses were strung from the crossbeam, one for each of the criminals here, who were hung with no trial for the crime they had done of harboring Jews very near. A young Polish Christian couple, two small children held tight in their arms, were forced to climb up on the platform, holding in their panicked alarms. At gunpoint, a Jewish family, mother, father, and little child, were all hung up that day so the Third Reich could say, death for all, without any trial. The crowd at gunpoint stood mute. Seven bodies swung high toward the sky. Some choking, then silence was all I could hear as small feet dangled on high. Quite numb, I stumbled on homeward, wanting to fall down and die. But I could not disappoint my dear Jewish friends, so all I could do was cry. My sins
were beginning to weigh heavily on my conscience. I wanted to speak with Father Yosef, but could not get to his village at the edge of the forest that day. Instead, I found a local church where the priest was saying Mass. It was a season of penitence. Several people were waiting to enter the confessional. Finally, my turn came. An unpriestly encounter. I pulled shut the wooden door. Beyond the screen, a shadowy profile of my confessor appeared to me. I mumbled through my sins, stealing food, lying, wishing death on my enemies, and as the priest began to mutter, Te absolvo, I interrupted him. One more thing, I said, and I drew a breath to pull that from my shame. The mistress of a German officer I have become to save my Jewish friends. A mortal sin, is this my child? He said with no hesitation. If you do this, your soul you'll lose. And, after all, they are Jews. A chill arising from the floor. Something changed in me forevermore. I could not throw their lives away, even for absolution on that day. As I put the church behind me, I felt God's hand surround me and knew I had his blessing. I was never more sure of anything. Christmas, 1943. Content with me in holiday time, Major Rugemer invited my friends upstairs. We danced and sang till the midnight clock rang. One would think we hadn't a care. As I closed the basement door that night, they, feeling safe for the first time in years, I headed upstairs to Rugemer's bed, my heart tied in knots and new fears. I had learned that Ida was pregnant and had decided to abort. No, I said vehemently, it's your future that you must court. We'll wait then, she agreed. God's our guide, we will hide, and hope for the best in between. January 1944. As the fighting continued on the Russian front, battles were moving closer to Ternopil. In the cold silence of January nights, I could hear the shelling to the east. Rumors were spreading that Hitler had become unhinged and paranoid. And meanwhile, Major Rugemer had become increasingly distracted and preoccupied as he prepared to dismantle and move the ammunition factory back toward the west. One night, Major Rugemer took my hand. I have bad news to tell you, Irina. Berlin sent word. A rumor has reached them that I have a Polish girlfriend. I have to dismiss you. Now, my friends in the basement of Major Rugemer's house had to be moved or would face certain death. So, while Rugemer left Ternopil for 2 days to tend to business in a new city, I devised a plan. Secret plans. In the quiet of the morning, I devised a secret plan to take 4 of the men to the forest with picks and shovels in hand. There, they would dig out a hollow, making room for 6 more folk. Spring would soon be coming, and this was our only hope. Be ready by this afternoon. I prepared the men to leave. Henry would wear the major's coat with a swastika on its sleeve. With a click of his heels and a Nazi salute, oh, this deceit was so much fun. A German soldier even saluted us with no idea that we were on the run. Next, I gathered the women together to help devise a plan. Helen would bring the farm wagon. We'd pack blankets and pots and pans. We joined the throng of wagons fleeing toward the west. Dressed in shawls and peasant garb, we looked like all the rest. Horns honked and horses neighed as we passed over ruts in the road. Everyone headed the other way now. What hope 4 years could corrode? We stayed with the convoy of refugees till the road to the forest veered right. Clara and Fanka went into the woods to live under the stars at night.
And then we went to the forester's house, where Ida would soon give birth, hidden behind a secret wall, her child a triumph on earth. With my friends safe in the forest, I now needed to find a way to escape from my German captors. The escape. Major Rugemer came 2 days later, with SS Rokita in the car. "Listen, Irina," said my cousin, "they're going to take you far." With urging in his voice, he spoke as one to kin. "When you get to Kieke, run away from those men. They're nothing but bad news and sin. Find my brother-in-law in Ovosova. Ask directions, he's known in the town. And there you may join with the partisans and continue your fight on the ground. Your light, Irina, will shine in the dark. You will continue, Irina, to leave your mark." In Kieke, I met brave Yannick. Mercedes Benz was his partisan name. It was love at first sight, I must confess. A true love this time, without any shame. I followed Yannick into the forest, where he tested my courage and nerve, carrying money and notes between partisan spies. I soon passed the test to serve. Blessed by a partisan priest, I was given my partisan name. Mawa it was, meaning little. Appropriate for me, I must say. They gave me a capsule of poison to swallow if captured, I swore. And here in the forest we lived for a time, hunted, excited, and much, much more. Our wedding we planned for my birthday. May 5th was the date it would be. But Yannick was killed in an ambush, and our wedding we never would see. Dark days for me did follow. That poison pill loomed in my mind. My true love had died with such violence. I might as well too, I surmised. But the partisan priest took my hand. "There is work," he said, "still to be done. You cannot die now, little Mawa." So I picked up myself and my gun. In December of 1944, I contracted pneumonia and was deathly ill for 3 months. In April 1945, Hitler killed himself. The war was stumbling to an end. Poland had been liberated by the Soviets. My Jewish friends in the forest would now be free. I was tired and had no more strength for fighting. Now I needed to find my family. I began traveling across my battered country. All over Poland there were signs urging the partisans to surrender, but I refused to fall into that trap and had no intention of crossing paths with the Soviet army again. In Radom, no one knew where my family was, but I learned that many Jews from Ternopil had migrated to Krakow. In Krakow, I hunted the temples and the synagogues, reciting the names of my friends, and finally I found Fanka, who was working for a tailor. She told me that all of my friends were in Krakow except for Ida and Lazar Haller and their new baby, Roman, who was in Katowice. The next few days were filled with joyous reunions, and then I left for Katowice. A hunted mother hen. Feeling like mother hen, my cheeks all together again, I took a train to Katowice, a mere 60 kilometers away, to visit with Ida and Lazar and meet baby Roman. Hooray! Arriving, I went to the temple and met with the rabbi there. Greeted with cold suspicion, so blonde and German I appeared. But when I gave him my name, Irina, he looked at me quite amazed, and then he threw his arms around me and held me with love in his gaze. I was arrested by the Soviets on my way to greet my friends that day. The Soviets believed, so it seemed,
that little Mawa was leader of the partisans. Through days of intense interrogation, they got nothing at all out of me, only that I, a poor Polish girl, had been enslaved by their cruel enemy. After days of futile questions, they assigned me to be a maid, cleaning the Soviet men's room, to punish my silence, they said. But once again, Lady Luck took my hand in a hall near the dressing room door, an open window with bars I did see, enough space for one small as me. I jumped through the open window, fell two flights to the ground below, limped my way home to the Howlers, swollen feet but no broken bones. As my feet began to heal, through the grapevine news came my way that I was hunted throughout southern Poland, a dangerous criminal, the Soviets would say. My mother and sisters had been arrested for crimes that I had done, and before the war had ended, my father, not stepping off the sidewalk, had been killed with a Nazi gun. Then, all hope was taken from me when I learned a bit later on that my mother and sisters had been released and were hiding now underground. I must now give up my search or endanger them all, it was clear. But where could I go? No country had I. As a criminal, I trembled with fear. I felt numb. I felt sad. My mind lost in a fog. I faced this blank wall for almost 1 year. May 1946. Now my Jewish friends took charge of me, giving testimony on my behalf and providing me with a new name and a passport to a new life. With my hair dyed black, I traveled by train to Germany and took up residency in a repatriation camp for displaced Jewish persons. A new life. Disguised as a Jew, I took the train seeking shelter in Germany at a camp for displaced Jews. My new name? Sonia Sofierstein. What was I escaping from? The Russians, of course, but more. A baby being thrown in the air and shot like a bird. It was 7 years since my childhood had ended. Where was I headed? Where could I land? This was more than I could understand. At the camp, there was an eerie silence. Even children at play made no noise. Snatched from a senseless universe, some had never even seen a toy. I showed my papers to a rabbi, told him the truth, who I really was. He welcomed me there as a hero, and my world soon began to buzz. 3 years I lived in this camp, joy beginning to come back to me, and one day the rabbi took me aside and said that a delegate from the UN wanted to hear my story. William Opdyke was the delegate's name. I told my story without any shame. At the end, he put his pen down. I expected to see the man frown. Instead, he spoke these words. Through the translator's lips I heard. Mr. Opdyke says he feels honored to have met you, and the United States of America would be proud to have you as a citizen. Me? America? I asked. Mr. Opdyke extended his hand, and I shook it, while we both nodded solemnly at one another. America, he repeated. America. And thus began my journey toward freedom in America. I traveled by boat to New York City, where I lived in Brooklyn. Here, I learned to speak English and became an American citizen.
One day in 1956, I was sitting in a cafe close to the UN building on the east side of New York City when I ran into Mr. Opdyke, who was recently widowed. He asked me out on a date, and 6 weeks later we were married. Our daughter, Janina, was named after my sister, who I did not see for many years. After Poland became a democracy, I was reunited with all of my sisters. By then, we were all very old, but we were still the very same people. My mother had passed away. In 1982, on a long-awaited trip to Israel, I was finally able to meet Roman, the baby who had been born to Ida and Lazar Haller behind the wall in my cousin the Forester's house. The Israelis welcomed me and gave me the honor of being one of the righteous among nations. It seems that the Hotvax prediction had indeed come true. Finally, we were living in California, and my husband was unable to speak at a meeting of the Rotary Club, so I took his place. About the same time, I was reading about people who were denying that the Holocaust had ever taken place. I was so upset that for the first time in my life as an American, I publicly told my story. Even my daughter Janina did not know it. And since then, I have not stopped telling this story. I want to leave you today with one important thought. We are all part of one family. The greatest gift that we can give in life is love, compassion, and respect for every human being living on this earth. And always remember that one person, no matter how young or how little, can indeed make a difference. I want to thank you for listening to my story. The following epic performance poem, written and performed by Janet Rogers, is based on the autobiography of Arena Gut Opdyke titled In My Hands.